last evening. It was quite a delight for me to observe that. One of you is here tonight and wasn't able to do this last evening. Gary tries to confuse all of us with the schedule and does a pretty good job for some of us as teachers trying to figure out where we're supposed to be. And then one of us this evening has a serious migraine headache, and those are real things and they can really put you down. So we want to be thinking about Elijah as well, as he'll not be joining us this evening. So do you have a copy of the portfolio? Everybody make sure you put your name on your portfolio and then leave it on the chair. That way you don't lose it. If I lose it, it's on me. I'll be collecting those so that you'll get them back every day. And then on Friday, you'll be receiving that to take home with you for future reference. Ben Hardy.
Yes.
There he is. All right. And Braden.
Right here.
Okay. Braden Roth and Caleb Gwynn. You guys are seated not in your respective places of abode, so you're throwing me off. Very good. And Clay Johnson, Daniel McConaughey, Elijah Roberts. Okay, I didn't remember his last name. I just remembered Elijah. Okay. And Ethan Hodge. And Ethan Maxey, Evan Williams, and Gabe Reynolds. Jack Dryden and Joe Hardy. Okay, thank you. Okay, and Joshua Balsamo. I'm watching you, buddy. I'm watching. Okay, don't let Peyton lead you astray. Okay. And Lee Reich. Thank you, sir. And Lucas Mayberry. Luke Eaton. And Luke Norfleet. Luke Smelser and Matthias Mitchell and Peyton Roth and Weston Bove. Is that close enough?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. All right. Been practicing, so glad you're here with us, Weston. All right, let's take time to pray together, guys. Our Holy Father, thank you so very much for allowing us to be called your children. Thank you for allowing us to come before you. Thank you for giving us access through your Holy Spirit and through your Son who makes intercession for us. Thank you that your Spirit can intercede for us with groanings that are just too deep for words. We just don't know how to speak to you sometimes. We thank you that you listen to our hearts. We thank you that you've always wanted relationship with us. You've always wanted to be our God and you've wanted us to be your people. Help us to have your kingdom ruling in our hearts. Help us to see you as the absolute monarch who has dominion over all the universe. May you rule in our hearts. May you help us in these troubled times to realize that you rule in the kingdoms of men and that you're able to exert your power to do just as you wish, allowing us to have our own choice, but not to avoid consequences of those choices. Thank you for our brothers. Thank you that we can be brothers in arms. Thank you that we can share our hearts, that we can trust each other, that we can develop confidences so that we can share burdens and we can help carry each other's load. And we can do that not just here at camp, but throughout the year, that we can be reminded of we know a brother who also has challenges and he's seeking you. Help me to seek you more. Help us to see the greatness of your power as you exerted it in the Babylonian kingdom and the Medo-Persian kingdom and Greeks and with the Romans, and help us to see what really lasts as we look at men like Daniel, who for 90 years plus make wise choices and influence various empires for you and for your cause. Help us to be men of influence as you place us with opportunities to show others more about your Son. We ask your blessing and your help together. In Jesus we pray.
Amen.
All right, let's just go over. Remember, we've got some guys here tonight who weren't here last night. And so if I'm making these strange movements, this is for the 2 and 3 year olds in the class, all right? My wife and my grandchildren are trying to teach me how to do these 17 periods. And I think the first one is supposed to be something like this. This represents the, so you've seen that video. So this is the universe that God created. So this is the period before the
flood.
And then we have the flood. And then we have people building a tower. And what does God do?
Scatters
the people and changes their languages so they spread out as he had directed. And after that, we have
four
patriarchs or first fathers. And they are?
Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph.
And now if we were following the lineage of Jesus, it would be Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and
Judah.
And we would learn that in Genesis 49, verse 10 or so. All right. And one of you, and I think it was the earlier class, noted that chapter 38 of Genesis is about Judah. And you know, these guys don't always look really good on paper. They're not always making really good choices. You've got Abraham the liar. You've got Isaac, the blind guy who gets duped, and you've got Jacob, the deceiver. And yet these are men who come to have faith in God and come to trust God and are men of great courage and faith. And so we want to appreciate that. Peyton, what you need?
Do we have an extra folder?
We sure do. I will grab it for you. Want everybody to have one? You need more than one?
Just one of them.
Okay, I'll lay them back there.
Okay, that's it.
There you go.
All right.
Thank you for asking.
Yep.
All right. And so what I want you to do is, I'm giving you the folder, but hopefully I'm going to give you the information in condensed form. But then when you go home, you can go back and review that. And there's some other information that I'd like to make available to you. It's called The History and Geography of the Bible Story by Bob and Sandra Waldron. And it has excellent information in this period between Malachi and Matthew for you to see what's unfolding in our world. And so yesterday we looked at a particular passage that told us that at just the right time, at just the right time, God was going to bring forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. Where was that? Galatians chapter 4, especially verse 4. And so God was orchestrating everything to bring it all to come at just the right time. How long had God had that plan in his mind? From the beginning of time, from before the foundation of the world, this was an eternal plan. What particular document would you read those statements in?
Ephesians,
particularly in chapter 1 and also in chapter 3. So those were pictures that we saw yesterday of God's plan. We also are now focusing on time, and you're probably going to need to write this down somewhere, either in your notes or in your Bible, because I'm used to PowerPoint, and the PowerPoint is Daniel chapter 2. So if you want to turn there, Daniel chapter 2 is going to help Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel, and us to see that hundreds and hundreds of years before it happened, God named people and empires that were going to ultimately bring about the coming of the king. And so kingdom themes are throughout the book of Daniel. If you were thinking about that first kingdom, it would be the Babylonian kingdom. I'm going to go ahead and give you a little chronology here, and then we'll come back and look at Daniel as a person. When was the Babylonian, known as the Neo-Babylonian kingdom, when was it in power? Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem in what year?
70.
Okay. 605. A lot. When I grew up, it was 606. We've got a little more archaeological information now, and the Chaldeans seem to keep some pretty careful records along with the Assyrians, so it looks like it was 605 BC. Don't consider somebody a heretic if he says 606 or 605, all right? That time period, Nebuchadnezzar swoops in, and he takes how many boys to be special?
Four.
Okay, good. Look, I'm glad those glasses are working. That's good. And you are going to name those boys for me?
Shadrach,
Meshach, and Abednego. Somebody want to tell us Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, all right? And Daniel or Belteshazzar, all right? And so those are the four guys. Now, there may have been more, but those are among those four guys that he calls in to be his special what? What was their role? What are these guys' role? What are they doing? They're political advisors. They're giving counsel. They are on the payroll to give and share wisdom and insights, particularly in regard to mysteries. And Daniel, of those four, is especially good with dreams and interpretation of dreams. And so I think yesterday we emphasized the fact that as we read in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel's saying he's not me. There's a God. There's a God in heaven. And what had the earlier magicians and conjurers and counselors said when Nebuchadnezzar, you tell me the dream and you tell me the interpretation? What did they say? Only the gods could do that. You're asking something that is humanly impossible. And so Daniel and his three buddies are doing what? Because they know they're about to die. They're praying for their life. And they're praying that God would give them the interpretation of the dream. These are probably teen boys. Tell me about them. Give me a profile. Facebook profile. How do they look? They're good looking. What else?
They're fit.
They're really bright. They get a full ride scholarship to Chaldean Babylonian school. Okay? All right? They are future MDs. And so they have all of the privileges. But what do they intentionally choose not to do that would have been really tasty?
Eat
the king's food. Instead, they're going to do the vegetable, the Daniel diet. The vegetables and the water. They're going to eat healthy. They're going to think healthy. They're going to be healthy. How long did Daniel live?
90+.
Why do you say 90+?
Because you said in your prayer.
Gave that one away. Why? Where would I have gotten the idea that Daniel might have been 90 years old?
Captivity was 70 years, so.
Let me do the simple number. I have to do simple math. Let's see, he's 20 when he gets there. And if he's in captivity for
70 years.
70 years, 20 and 70 is.
Wait.
Yeah, just trying to throw me off. Anyway. And so there's 90 years. You know anybody 90 years old? You know, you kind of have to make some pretty careful choices and be blessed genetically to live to be 90. Do you picture Sewell guzzling booze and smoking and doing pot in the 1930s? Is that the way you picture him? Or do you picture his dad as pretty serious and saying, now look, boys, this is what you're going to do. You're going to dig out these stumps and this, you know, you're going to be physically fit. You can ask Bill Hall about digging out stumps. And so Daniel and his buddies are men who are self-disciplined. Nebuchadnezzar's dead. His kids are dead. His grandkids are dead. What's happened to his kingdom in Daniel's lifetime?
It's falling apart.
It's gone. This superpower of Babylon that was just the zenith of power that wiped out Assyria is no longer on the planet as a kingdom. Look at the last verse of Daniel 1. Daniel 1. Daniel's going to live all the way till when?
First year
King Cyrus. So we just left the Babylonian Empire. What empire are we looking at now?
Neo-Persian.
Somebody said it right. I said it wrong. Medo-Persian. The Medes and the Persians. So when you get to Daniel chapter 5, you know, Belshazzar is the party animal, and he's going to blow things up. And who's going to come in and take over? What is that in Daniel chapter 5? Darius the... Darius the Mede, yeah. I don't know if it says that chapter. Darius the Mede. And so the Medes and Persians are coming in. And as your assignment was, which of the powers are greater, the Medes and the Persians? See, I dealt with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Austrians were always more strong than the poor Hungarians. And so you get the Medes and Persians. Which one's stronger? And I want you to prove to me that the second empire is the Medes and Persians, because I don't read Medes and Persians in Daniel chapter 2. Do you read Medes and Persians in Daniel chapter 2? I read about a second kingdom, but I don't read any Medes and Persians in chapter 2. Do you? Did you find Medes and Persians in Daniel 2? But you're talking like Medes and Persians are a done deal. So I want you to prove to me that this second part of this statue is representing the Medes and Persians. And Joe's on it. Go ahead.
6 verse 8.
Go ahead, what's the sixth verse say?
Now, O King, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter.
Okay, so Daniel's still living. In fact, he's a satrap. He is one of the official governors in the Medo-Persian Empire. Got that from chapter 5 and chapter 6. But how do we know how long that Medo-Persian Empire is going to last? And how do we know what's going to happen to the Medo-Persian Empire? That was a good passage. Is Daniel getting insight into the future of not only the Babylonian Empire, but even the Medes and Persians? And the answer is yes. You guys are supposed to slam dunk that because of your work in Daniel chapter 8. So if you haven't done that yet, now's a good time to get on. Yes, ma'am.
Just another Median Persia is in chapter 8, verse 20.
Oh, that's a really good place to be. All right, so everybody needs to be in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 20. In Daniel chapter 8 and verse 20, let's back up a little bit. And who's having this dream? You know, Nebuchadnezzar has the head of gold, he has the belly, the silver, and then the bronze, and then the iron mixed with clay. But this is a different picture. In Daniel 8, you got two animals. What are the two animals in Daniel chapter 8?
A ram,
a male among the sheep, and then you got a
goat.
And how many horns does the ram have? He's got two. Is one bigger than the other one? Yeah, one's bigger than the other. Wonder what that means. Maybe nothing, but could mean that the Persians are actually the stronger of the two in the empire. But then, does the ram beat the goat, or does the goat kill the ram? Goat crushes the ram. How many horns has he got?
One.
He got one big prominent horn. But what happens to that horn? It breaks off, and then there's four horns. And so what's that tell us?
That would be the Grecian Empire, where it split into the four generals.
Whoa. Where'd you get Grecian Empire there, Luke? Where'd you get Greece?
It's what comes after Persia, when Alexander the Great died, his four generals took over and split up the land.
I mean, Daniel 8.
Boom, he just slammed it. Okay, go Daniel 8.
Well, Daniel 8, 21, it says, and the male goat is the kingdom of Greece.
Oh, okay, so we've got Greece identified. Greece is nobody when Daniel was living. And Greece is just some little city-state, Sparta, Athens, and the Macedon area. It gets named Macedonia because of Philip of Macedon. Who's Philip's son, Philip of Macedon? Alexander the Great. And so Alexander's handed off, okay, General Alexander, here you are, you're 17, you're ready to go. You got it? Okay, 18, 19, 20. And so here comes Alexander, and he is a great genius. And you know, he is going to conquer the world, so to speak. He gets to the Indus River, and the myth is, I think it's mythological, that he cried because there were no more nations to conquer.
Right.
It's probably more accurate that he cried because his soldiers said, enough, we're not going to go any farther. But anyway, what happens to Alexander?
He dies.
He dies. After about 17 years of great work, he dies. Is he remembered today?
Mm-hmm.
Did he have a big influence in the world?
Yes.
Yeah. And he dies at about age 33 or so. You know anybody else that died around age 33?
Jesus.
And did you know when he started his advancement of his kingdom? He's about age 30. And does anybody remember Jesus of Nazareth, Galilee today? Who had the greater impact in the world?
Jesus.
Yes. And so Alexander's going to die of disease and fever when he's about 33 years old. And then after Alexander dies, Luke, I don't know how you know all this stuff, but his generals take over the various regions. And I think if you'll check your notes, you might find those four different generals. You might be able to tell me the different regions. I don't think their names are going to be given in this first lesson. But where are these generals dominating in world power? What areas? See something about Asia or Syria or Egypt or anything like that?
Greece, Syria, Asia Minor, and Egypt.
Okay, yes. And which of those two would predominantly have an influence on the Jews for the next 200 years?
Egypt.
The Ptolemies are going to be somewhat of a stabilizing factor for the Jews. But then Who's going to come down and say, we're going to rip your place up, we're going to defile your temple, and you're going to do what we say, and you're going to do it the Greek way, and your temple is done. Who's that? That's the Greeks. That's the Antiochus or the Antiochus leaders around 175 BC. Have any of you ever heard of the Maccabees?
Yes.
Yeah, Judas the Hammer. All right, maybe we'll learn a little more about that response. And what is the response and where Jesus would go in the Gospel of John to celebrate the victory that ran the Syrians out? The Feast of
Lights,
Hanukkah, Feast of Dedication, when the lights of the temple are relit. So we're doing a little bit of historical background from Daniel chapters 1 and 2 and Daniel chapter 8. Can you give me a throne scene picture from the book of Daniel where God is actually saying, here, son, here is the kingdom? What chapter in Daniel would you have the Ancient of Days delivering the kingdom, the domain, the rule, the power, the authority to his son of man? What chapter? That's good. That was almost a question mark. Yeah. You're right. It's Daniel chapter 7. And so what's happening after the kingdom is given to the son, you're going to have someone who's waging war against the saints. Is God going to allow that to happen? Is God going to allow people to wage war with the saints and overcome the saints?
No.
Yes, he is. Temporarily. Check me on it. Check me on it. And so I want you to think about a document in the New Testament where God's people are being worn out, whipped up, and killed because they won't bow down to the Caesar. And so God says, more will die. You rest for a while. And they're asking three questions. It's the same three questions we always ask when we're getting whooped on. God, do you know? And God, do you care? And God, what are you going to do about it? Calling for God to take vengeance on our enemies. What book would that be in the New Testament? You all know.
Psalms?
That's Revelation. Revelation. God, that's chapter 6, verse 9, souls under the altar. God, do you know what's happening? God, do you care? And God, what are you going to do about it? And God says, more will die. But then I'm going to send, who's going to march in with his white horse and come in and clean up the whole place?
Christ.
Here's Christ in chapter 19. Revelation, great. Great victory. Best movie ever. All right? And so I want you to see that power of the king. Sometimes we get whipped on for a while, but God says, I'll remember and I'll deal with it. All right? So the Son of Man is on his throne. Let me take a breath and think about this for a moment.
Can I get a folder?
Well, I wonder if you were just going to stand there forever. I hope so. Thank you, sir. Mr. Hodge, have a folder. Put your name on it, please, so I know how to get it back to you tomorrow. All right. Now, so what? You know, you got all this information, but you got Luke Eaton in the class, and he's just telling you about all this neat stuff about the Greeks. And what did the Babylonians bring to the Jews, and what did the Jews bring to the Babylonians? Either one. Did the Babylonians really know much about Jehovah, Yahweh, God? He was just one among all the gods. But through the influence of what four guys did they really come to really learn about the God of heaven who has created the heavens and the earth and who rules in the kingdoms of men?
And Azariah and Daniel.
Yes, you see those guys and you see their influence on the Babylonian culture. Now, did Babylonian culture have any influence on the Jews? I mean, you're living there. Ezekiel says, hey, start building your houses. We're going to be here a while. What do they not have access to? By the way, Ezekiel's 30 when he starts this work, it seems. If he was back home, he would have been working in the temple as a priest. So where can't they go for every Passover and Pentecost and Day of Atonement?
Jerusalem.
They can't go to Jerusalem. They can't go to the temple. So do they still love God? They still want to serve God? They still want to get together and worship together? Where are they going to get together?
The synagogues.
Synagogues? Really, Christopher, you think so? So where do you start reading about synagogues?
Acts
ask our scholar Tommy Peeler today. Psalm, I think he said 78, maybe? Wrote it down. I don't read my notes. That there might be some reference to an assembly like that. But, you know, we just start reading in the New Testament and Jesus is going to the synagogue. But we don't read about synagogues much at all in the Old Testament. It may have been Psalm 74. That'll give you enough time to read through several Psalms to find it. But as you think about that, they wanted to get together. And we're going to look later. By the way, how many guys did you have so you could have a synagogue? Yeah, there's 10. Yeah, and so they kind of just made up some rules. And so we want to get together, and we want to meet, and we want to read. And by the New Testament, most of the people all over the empire that are Jewish are meeting in synagogues. They're Jewish church buildings. So that's one thing that we're learning, something that probably came out of the Babylonian captivity. What language would these people have spoken? When you think of even the books of Ezra and Nehemiah.
The language of the Babylonians.
All right, you'd think Chaldean. I mean, that's one of the things they had to learn. It's what these guys had to learn when they got there. They had to learn the Chaldean language. But if you're doing the international language of trade throughout the whole Fertile Crescent, what language would that be?
Greek. Mm-hmm.
All right. Greek hasn't really taken dominance yet. Somebody said
Aramaic.
Aramaic. But hold on. No, don't give up on the Greek. All right.
I won't.
Yeah, because that's going to be helpful here. And so there's an Aramaic language. There's a common business language that goes throughout the world. And when you travel throughout the world today, there's going to be one or two or three predominant languages that most everybody has to learn in order to do international business. Okay? And we are extremely blessed that English is one of those. Wow, you talk about access to talk to people. And so they had that. So there's the Aramaic. Now we move on to the Greeks. Go ahead, Luke.
I'm probably missing something obvious, but where do the Jews ever get confirmation from God that synagogues are okay to meet in?
I don't know where it would be if he did. But why would we think it's okay to meet in synagogues without God just saying,
yes, I want synagogues?
I mean, Paul, like, talked
to the Jews. Maybe even higher than Paul.
Jesus.
Yeah. You know, Jesus goes to the synagogues. He teaches in synagogues. He goes back to home. Town synagogue in Nazareth, so it must have been okay. It's kind of, we're going to learn that something about translations too.
In my mind, I just think of synagogues as like Jewish Bible studies.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's not technically worship, it's just people getting together to study their scriptures.
Well, yeah, we can work on the worship concept, but certainly it's a place where Jews got together to learn about God. But I want you to think, by the time of Jesus, is there only Jews getting together in the synagogues? It's predominantly for Jews, but is anybody else allowed in? You see, in the temple, were the Gentiles allowed into the temple?
No.
Now, there was an outer court where they could stand out there, and then there was the court of the women, and then there was the court of the men, and then there was the place where the Levites and then the priests did their work. But the Gentiles really weren't allowed in. I think I heard or read something about, Gentile, you better not go beyond this point, or it'll cost you your life. But in the synagogues, who's coming into the synagogues? Jews and two other groups that Luke will distinguish those two groups.
Proselytes
and the God-fearers. People that fear God, but they may not have converted to Judaism yet. Can you think of any God-fearers in the New Testament that...
Cornelius?
Exactly. Here's a guy who fears God with all his house. But he doesn't seem to have converted to Judaism, but he's certainly looking for God. So there were a lot of those when you read through the actions of the apostles. And so that's something that's opened up, and that's a new medium, that's a new venue for the gospel. Where do they go first when they take the gospel? Go to the synagogues. They go with people who are looking for God, and then they move into the marketplace, they go to the agora, and they spread it all over. And so what are your mediums today to take the gospel? Are most people going to your church building today? Especially not with COVID. But are most people walking into your church building? Where are they checking you out as far as what your belief system is?
Website.
Your website. That's right. That's your new symbol. The website is where millennials are going to go first before they ever step into your auditorium. And so we have a new platform for sharing the gospel. And so the synagogue was that. So let's come back, let's come on down to the Greeks. What did the Greeks give the world? Alexander wanted everybody to be a Greek. And so he wanted Hellenism to dominate. What does that mean, Hellenism? Why would we call it Hellenism? Any Hellenists in the New Testament who were Christians?
The Hellenistic Jews are referenced a lot. I'm not sure.
Absolutely. That and so what does that mean, all right? And so you got any women who were Hellenist?
Hellenistic widows.
Ah, in Acts chapter...
Six? Seven?
Yeah. And so you've got these people who have imbibed the Greek culture. Either they are Greeks or they're simply adopting that Greek culture, and they're known as Hellenists. And so did the traditional Jews have a little bit of a rub against the Hellenists? Because some of the Jews don't really like the Greek culture and Greek influence. We're thinking of Pharisees and Zealots particularly. Go ahead, Ben.
Clarification comment.
Sure.
So, like Greek culture and Hellenists are like synonyms, right?
They really are. Helen of Troy was the great goddess of the Greeks.
Okay, cool.
And so to promote Hellenism is to promote the Greek culture. Saying the same thing two different ways.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm glad you asked that. And so we've got the Babylonians. They're around 600 to about when? I'm going to do our timeline. We got off of the wagon there. 605 to about 530. Yeah, 535, 536, 538, somewhere around there. Because God, 200 years earlier, has announced there's going to be a king who's going to allow you to go home. He's my shepherd, and he's going to allow you to rebuild the temple. What's that king's name?
Cyrus,
last verse of Daniel chapter 1. So when did the Medo-Persians rule the world? When did the Medes and Persians rule the world? When Babylon falls, let's say, 535 or so, down to about when? It'd be helpful to write this down. One of the other guys said, I need to be able to see this in a linear way. He didn't say linear. So the Medes and Persians are ruling from somewhere around 500 or a little earlier down to about when? When do the Greeks say, we're tired of you coming in here and whooping on our cities and we're going to come back at you? Somewhere around 350 or so. Alexander the Great dies when? About 331, 332, somewhere around there. And so then the Greeks are the world power. But who's going to start burgeoning up with their power, and they're going to be distributed all over the world, lots of different peoples, lots of different languages, and they're going to kind of stick together, they're going to kind of adhere, but it's kind of like putting clay and iron together. When do the Romans, when do they really step up and start taking over the world?
During the time of Christ, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a little bit before that. And it's really hard to date that because of various events, but I'd say about at least 50 years before Jesus is a relative number. Maybe you could argue 100 years before Jesus. Have you ever heard of Julius Caesar? Have you ever heard of Cleopatra? Have you ever heard of Octavian or the Caesar Augustus? The triumvirate, Brutus and Cassius, all of that history, see, that's all happening before Jesus. In fact, Octavian has now become the Caesar, August Caesar, and he said there's going to be a census. How did that relate to Jesus?
That brought them to Bethlehem.
That brought them to Bethlehem. And what had God said through
Micah
chapter 5, verse 2? The child would be born in Bethlehem. August Caesar doesn't even know what he's doing, but he's doing exactly what God told him to do.
Crazy.
In bringing the Christ into the world. It is crazy. It's amazing. And so as you see all of that, then the Greeks bring us what? You have to get that one in. They bring us the language of the world. What is that Greek language called that's very common?
Koine.
Yeah, koine, koine. I don't know how to say it. We'll just have to ask the Greeks. And so it's a common language. It's not the classical Greek of Homer, but it's a common Greek. And everybody that went to school learned that language. But did Jesus go to school? In fact, that's one of the objections that the Jewish rulers have, is he's some of this dumb clod from up in the hills of Galilee. He couldn't know anything. He didn't come down to our school. He didn't come to our church school down here in Jerusalem. So how could he know anything? I don't know if Jesus ever learned Koine Greek. I suppose he did, but what language? Well, I'm pretty sure he knew. That's the Aramaic. And so the Jews who've been in captivity, I'll try to get to you in just a minute, but the Jews who've been in captivity in Babylon, when they get ready to come home and rebuild the temple, I'm moving back to Cyrus and the Persians. Cyrus is funding this rebuilding of the temple. What do the kids not know?
Hebrew.
They don't know Hebrew. They don't know their ancient language. And so what has to happen in Nehemiah chapter 8? somebody's got to do what for the kids? It's kind of like us trying to tell you the King James language. Well, I don't speak Elizabethan English. So you have to have somebody to translate. And so there was a translation. Let me move with that to, was there a translation that would help people, Jew and non-Jew, that didn't know ancient Hebrew, that they could know about the coming of Jesus? Was there a translation?
Septuagint.
Tell me about the Septuagint.
Is that a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament?
Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And where was that put together? In a big city in Egypt, known for Alexander the Great. Alexandria. Huge library there. And here are these 70-so guys putting together in the Greek language, the Old Testament Hebrew. Did Jesus approve of that translation?
Yes.
Yes, he did. In fact, he used it a lot. And the quotations of the New Testament are a lot from the Septuagint. So that really helps us with, oh, it's okay to translate the Hebrew Scriptures. It must be. Jesus used it, the apostles used it. And so as we think about that, that's a tremendous way. So who's now reading about the fact that someone is coming? Is it just Jews? Anybody who picks up a Greek copy of this ancient writing is going to know about Jesus. So let's for a moment think about some major things. And Brother Hall did it yesterday. I should have asked you yesterday when it was fresh on your memory. Some major things people could look for to say, hey, when the Messiah comes, he's going to be born in... He's going to be born of, and he's going to be a king, a savior. He's going to be a high priest. He's going to be a king. He's going to be a prophet.
Priest.
Anything else?
There's going to be something like Elijah.
There's going to be somebody who's going to come and be the preparer. The guy who is the highway, yes, in the spirit and power of Elijah. So they've got all this stuff to think about. And so when Jesus is born, is there anybody really looking for the Messiah? Start naming some people you can think of, or groups. But when he actually appears, there are people who are waiting for him, looking for him.
Pharisees.
Okay, yeah, the Pharisees are. They're very serious. Can you think of some names? Some wise men from the east. They recognize that the king has been born. Who else? Some people in the temple.
Simeon.
And Anna. Yes. And go ahead, Luke.
The zealots.
Yes. All right. Did some people have a misguided view of what the Messiah was going to do? Yeah. Some people wanted a military leader. Some people wanted a political leader. And some people wanted a savior. Right? Same kind of challenges that we face today. All right. We've got the Greeks. What do the Romans bring? Greeks bring culture. Greeks bring language. Greeks bring gymnasiums, which is not necessarily so good, particularly in the way that they did all that. You were in Ezekiel class, you know what I'm talking about. And so there's culture, and the Jews are opening their minds to different ways of thinking. Some good, some not so good. They've got language. What else do they have? The times of the Romans, what did they bring to the
roads?
Roads. Roman roads. And they're still there. I mean, you can still go on the Appian Way. You can still go on the Ignatian Way. The Roman roads are all over the place. And what else did they bring to the people?
Peace.
Peace. The Pax Romana. They took the piracy off of the Mediterranean Sea. They made the shipping lanes safe. They made the roads, and they made it so that you could travel throughout the empire. And who had special benefits in the Roman Empire?
Citizens.
How did you get to be a citizen of the Roman Empire?
You're either born or you could buy it.
All right, born or you could buy it. And we remember some of the men who were about to beat Paul say, I had to pay a big price for my citizenship. What particular colony of Rome was so proud, although they were Philip of Macedon people, and I just tried to give you the name of the city, and yet they said, we are Romans. Philippi. Yeah, and so they recognized the privileges and benefits. If any of you ever had military connections, the commissary, the PX, and all of those benefits were a part of the Roman Empire. And so they brought the roads, they brought protection, they brought safety, and they brought the ability to travel throughout the empire. What else did the Romans bring?
An iron rod.
They bring a pretty strong force. They wanted things to be done peacefully. Were the Jews always a peaceful people? Did they chafe against some of the Roman rule? Thought Jesus would be the answer to all of their problems. So those are some helpful things that we learned in connection with that. What are your questions, observations, before we go over the periods of Bible history? Go ahead.
What were the Psalms you were talking about yesterday?
Let me pull that real quickly, as that's going to bug me if I don't find.
Psalms 74 talks about a sanctuary.
Does it?
Yeah,
okay.
Verse 7. I don't know if it's the one you were looking for.
Yeah. I asked Tommy about that this morning. And I wrote it down, but as you can tell, I haven't been carefully following my notes. I think it is Psalm 74.
It also says in verse 2, to remember your congregation.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Psalm 74 is the reference, and he said verse 8, but you can see that section of the sanctuary, and it seems that they began meeting in what they came to know as synagogue, Psalm 74. Yes, sir.
So, just to clarify, so the synagogues that we read about in the New Testament, they brought that back from Babylon?
And when you think about that, where did the Jews, and that's a helpful point, where did the Jews live after Babylon has fallen? Where did the Jews live?
Really,
but all over the world, because what was the Assyrian goal? How did they handle captive people?
Split them up.
That's right. Babylon said, no, we're going to take you, we'll take the best of you, and we're going to put you right here, and we're going to put you by the river here. So they colonized them, but the Assyrians split them up. So when the Jews came back home to build their temple, what tribes came back?
Random ones.
Somebody from all the tribes. Now, there was a false teaching several years ago in Armstrongism that taught that only the tribe of Judah came back, and we're still waiting to recollect the rest of the tribes. That's not true when you start reading the genealogies. There were people from all the tribes that came back to rebuild because Cyrus has taken all of what was formerly Assyria and all of what was formerly Babylon, and he has said, look, I'm going to be a kind and benevolent leader, and I'm going to bless you and fund your ability to go back home. That wasn't just for the Jews. But so any Jew was free to go back home to help rebuild the temple. All right, so you got all of those Jews involved. Yes, sir.
Didn't that benefit him in the form of making him pay taxes and stuff like that?
Oh, sure. There were some really good benefits for him. And he sounds good on paper. He wasn't always very nice. Xerxes wasn't very nice either. But they did bring about a blessing. And so can God take bad men and bring about good results?
Yes.
Could he do that with Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar wasn't a nice guy. But could God teach him that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men? Can God take bad leaders today and still bring about good results? Yeah. And not take away their will. Could God break Pharaoh down and get the people out of Egypt? Yeah. What does Pharaoh want? Right, yes, Paul.
How would they handle the sacrifices when they were in captivity in Babylon? I've always wondered that because, like, they probably weren't allowed livestock.
There's no temple. You know, you got to have the Levites, you got to have the priests, you got to have the temple. You see, God said, I will show you the place where I will put my name. By the way, can you any of you remember where the first place was when they came into the land, where they worshiped early on? And if you can think about Joshua 22, those of you who were in Joe's class today, that should give you a heads up on that. Where was the holy place before Jerusalem?
Shiloh.
Very good. Yeah, you know that. Yeah, Shiloh. And later you'll read about, well, Shiloh's nothing anymore. And so Jerusalem was the place where God's name was. That's what Solomon had prayed when we pray toward this place. So they're praying directed back toward Jerusalem. But there couldn't be the sacrifices. Yes, sir, Mr. Washington.
Sorry.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one. It's just some timers. It's not all time yet. Go ahead. All right. What other questions? That was a good one. I like that. All right, let's do our periods of Bible history. One more, you got it now?
When Daniel looked towards the east and prayed, why was that? Because, like, Jerusalem was towards the west.
That's a good question. What?
Could it might have been because the temple faced east?
Yeah. Yeah, if I'm remembering, and now, guys, I'm feeling on the spot. The entrance to the temple, wasn't it to the east?
Yeah. That's what we said in Ezekiel.
Yeah, well, if Ezekiel said it,
yeah,
count on it, okay? All right, it's a good question about the prayers. Let's go ahead and do the periods real quickly. Pre-flood, flood,
scattered people.
Patriarchs.
Patriarchs.
Exodus.
Wandering in the wilderness.
Wandering in circles.
Judges.
Invasion and conquest.
Judges. United Kingdom. Together. United Kingdom. Divided Kingdom. Jew alone. Captivity. Return from captivity. Years of silence.
Life of Christ. Early church.
And let us to the Christians. Good job. Way to go, guys. All right. It's good time.
Thank you.
I'm
staying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think I'm right here.
Alan, you're supposed to leave.
Yeah, leave your folders here, please. Just put them on the chair. I'd like you to put your name on one.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure I'm in the
Tuesday night. Yeah, that's
where.
Sorry.